That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show. I am That Money Guy. I like to say my name is also Gabriel, but for the purposes of this show, we stick to That Money Guy. It makes complete sense. And our objective here is simple. I've got you hopefully for about an hour or so. And in 60 minutes or in that hour, I will make you better with money. It's almost a guarantee. It happens 9 times out of 10. In fact, 99 out of 100 times. I'm that confident. And the reason why we are able to make you better with your money is quite simple. We discuss the news, but not the boring news. The actual news that affects the money that sits inside of your pocket. The stuff that you need to know. The stuff that you've probably been ignoring a little bit too much. In particular, this week, we've got something big happening on Thursday. I hope most of you are aware. And that's the majority of our discussion for today. And then straight after that, I bring in two incredible guests. We've got Becky O'Connor, the Director of Public Affairs at PensionB, and Tayo Ogunetanade, the co-founder of Bricks with Tips. Two very exciting guests, but my most exciting guest is sat here right now in the studio. I hope my two next guests aren't listening to that. If they are, I'll say that for each of you, I promise. But a very exciting guest. I've got Christine Farquharson, economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, sat right opposite me. How are you doing? Welcome to the studio.
I mean, after that intro, I'm both nervous and very excited. Most exciting guest. That's quite the
I put a little bit too much pressure on you.
Yeah, you did.
we'll let the audience decide in about 15 minutes or so whether they agree with that. Or at the end of the show, we'll do like a little poll to
see who's the best guest. Data-driven approach.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. Analytical guy. And speaking of analytical guys, we've got two strong front runners for the election coming up. Obviously, Labour and Tories. They do tend to be the ones that get most of the headlines. And the reason why we've got you in the studio here today is to ask you a little bit about what's actually going on. What are some of their policies to do with finances? Because the majority of people listening to the show are most interested in that specific topic. And we'd love to give you the full plethora of what they're going to be talking about, these guys that are hopefully fighting for your vote. But we'll stick to just the money topics. So on that note, should we take a little look at what are the key financial policies within, we'll go with the Labour, the Tories, maybe we can sprinkle in some Lib Dems and some other parties, but we'll stick with the main two for sure. So are you happy to kind of give us a whistle-stop tour?
Yeah, that sounds great. So I think the background to this, the big picture takeaway here, is when you look at the Labour manifesto and the Conservative manifesto, actually just how small they are in fiscal terms. If you look at the tax pledges and the spending pledges that these two main parties have made, compared to both other parties, smaller parties running in this election, but also to recent history, things like the 2019 election, 2017 election, these manifestos are small. Labour in particular is promising something like £5 billion of giveaways, matched by about £5 billion of takeaways by 2028. £5 billion, obviously a very big number in absolute terms, but when we're talking about the public finances, that's really pretty small beer. And so we're left in this world where actually the Conservative Party, who've been in power for the last 14 years, are promising a more radical change than the Labour Party, who are wanting to take power and emblazon the word change on every single page of their manifesto.
That's super interesting, because obviously logic would tell you it should be the other way around, right? The ones that are fighting to get into power, that aren't in power, should be telling you all these drastic things to get your vote. But obviously, with the polls telling us that Labour are very, very strong favourites to get into power, it's actually like the Tories are the ones that aren't in power right now and are trying to do the drastic things to get your vote. But are they actually doing anything quite drastic?
So the Conservatives have a couple of really of kind of moderately sized policies, let's say. On the sort of giveaway side, the biggest thing that they're doing for sort of ordinary people would be that they want to take 2p off the rate of national insurance contributions.
Again.
And that kind of follows on what we've seen the last couple of budgets, fiscal events, where they've been gradually ratcheting down that national insurance contribution tax rate. Now, national insurance, we sometimes think of as being, oh, well, that's the money for pensions. That's the money for the NHS. Really, it's just income tax by another name. There are some changes in the base, so it's paid more by younger people. But really, this is income tax by another name. It all goes into the same big pot.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of big giveaway on the Tory side. They're paying for that in a couple of different ways. The first thing that they want to do, which is in common with Labour and a lot of other parties as well, is they reckon that they can get a lot of tax revenue from cracking down on avoidance and evasion. So getting the people who owe tax to actually pay it. And that's not a silly thing to want want to do. We've made a lot of progress in closing what's called the tax gap. So in sort of tackling that evasion, that avoidance. Where we are now, though, is most of the tax gap, most of the money that's not being paid, isn't sort of gigantic corporate companies that are illegally evading tax. It's small traders who are cash in hand, who aren't necessarily reporting when they do their jobs to HMRC. The other big thing that the Conservatives want to do is they want to take a big chunk out of working age welfare spending. And they've said that they're going to save about £12 billion a year by 2028 on largely health-related benefits, disability-related benefits. I think if you listen to the manifesto, the idea is, well, those have been skyrocketing. The rate of people flowing onto these benefits is huge. We've seen a really big change since the pandemic. And almost the Conservatives look at that and say, well, if that rate is so big, we just need to get back to somewhere like where we were before the pandemic and look at all the money we're going to save.
Yep.
I think the challenge there is that the policies they've announced to actually achieve that, most of them are already in place, so they don't actually get you any money. And the few that look like they are new, I think there's some really big questions about whether those are really going to deliver the savings that are going to then pay for this cut on national insurance.
Okay, so to kind of summarize, what it looks like is they're offering a cut to the average worker. Good thing. They are explaining some ways they're going to pay for it. Lots of question marks.
Lots of question marks. And, we could talk literally for your whole episode, I won't do it, on when we get into sort of specifics of the policies and specific question marks there. But big picture, there are these couple of bigger policies that shift money, basically a win for average earners, a win for people in the middle of the income distribution, a loss if you're on working age benefits, a win for the defense budget, and actually a loss for a lot of other areas of public services too.
Okay, so that's the Tories, let's say, headline grab, that 2p cut in national insurance, which they have done twice before in the past 12 months, it should be said. They're just doing it again. For those that are self-employed, I believe that national insurance is being cut completely or something along those lines.
I think there's a long-term ambition to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a question about how plausible that long-term ambition is going to be and over what horizon.
Got it. Right? I'm going to throw another question mark then into the mix for that one. So over to Labour now. Mm. What's their headline grabbing policy that makes you want to vote for them because it's going to make us all richer?
To be honest, the Labour Party manifesto on fiscal terms is even smaller than the Tories. And really what's happening there is we're seeing very small scale financial changes, very small tax increases on private schools, on private equity, on non-DOMs, small bits of increases on public service spending. So the biggest single change is probably an increase in investment spending that comes from this sort of Green New Deal that they want to introduce. So boosting a significant boost to green investment spending. On public services, there's a little bit of cash for the NHS, a smaller bit of cash for schools. Most of that is kind of funding new exciting offers that they want those services to deliver, like breakfast clubs, rather than really going in and plugging some of the holes that are starting to open up in those public services. So on fiscal terms, it's really steady as she goes. Of course, if you read the manifesto, that's not at all the impression you get, because you look at it and you see they've promised something like 17 reviews and strategies. What are the chances that none of those reviews and strategies are going to end up costing anything? I would say slim.
Okay, understood. So nothing quite as attractive from their side. A lot of what both parties are promising at the moment is this idea of no changes to tax. Mm. So no changes to income tax. I think from the Labour perspective, no changes to national insurance tax. VAT as well, no changes to that. Is there anything else that they haven't quite mentioned which essentially makes us think probably going to be a change in that section?
So the three taxes that you've mentioned are the big three, and they account for something like 2/3 of tax revenues in the UK. So already saying you're not going to do anything there is taking an awful lot off the table. And, you know, as a side note, I think we at the IFS have been pretty critical of that. Not because we think that everybody should be paying whacking loads more in tax, but because there are fundamental problems with the design of each of those three. And when you say we're not going to do anything, you're also ruling out making them better.
Got it.
So there's some challenges there. But putting that aside, even on the revenue raising side, that still leaves loads of other taxes on the table. Capital gains tax, inheritance tax, corporation tax, fuel duty, tobacco duty, alcohol duty, there's loads. And partly that's a kind of issue in and of itself. The tax system has gotten so much more complicated as politicians basically try and avoid at all costs changes to those big three taxes and look for other opportunities to raise money because they've boxed themselves into a corner by ruling out these bigger changes.
Mm-hmm. And of course, no changes often means no decrease in those tax levels as well. And the one thing that I like to talk about in particular is this idea of no changes to our income tax band threshold. For those of you that obviously are aware of this idea called fiscal drag, both parties have kind of agreed to lock in the thresholds up until 2028, meaning that they don't get worse, but they also don't get better. And more of us are being dragged into paying more income tax just as a point of inflation. I mean, we want inflation to be around 2% in this country. So that means naturally earnings do go up on a year-on-year basis. And more people are falling kind of prior to that aspect. So it is really vital to listen to what they're not saying as much as what they are saying. One thing that Labour have mentioned, which was a really interesting one I did see, is this idea of extending the national living wage to 18-year-olds and, their words, making it a genuine living wage. That's not a number, so we don't know what genuine living wage is. Is there anything else you can tell us about that policy and general thoughts on this?
So if you take the current national living wage, it's about £11.44 for people who are 21 and older, and it's about £8.60 for those who are 18 to 20. And the logic for that is that, number one, if you're a slightly younger person, you have more to gain just from being in a workforce. You come in with maybe fewer skills, fewer experience, and you start to pick up some of that human capital. So in effect, some of the compensation you're getting comes from being trained rather than money in your pocket. Mm-hmm. And you can argue about whether or not that really looks fair. I think when we have seen over the longer term a progression, so there used to be a lot more age bands in the national minimum wage, and we've started to see those flatten out as the living wage gets extended lower and lower and lower down the age distribution. The big question there for me is going to be what kind of unintended consequences there might be. So, for example, if you think that there are employers out there who are looking at 18 to 20 year olds and going, they're cheap, I like that, I'll take some of that, please. You might think that there are a lot of 18 to 20s who are being employed because they're almost preferentially treated from the employer's point of view. If you equalize that, is that going to start to change? On the other hand, if you think that, if you believe this story, that younger people are benefiting from the additional training that they're getting, then again, as you equalize that, you start to remove the incentives for employers to employ them. That's not to say that we're heading for Armageddon or anything like that. You know, we've seen actually a lot of success in the UK of raising the living wage over a sustained period of time. And now it is much higher, both in cash terms, but more importantly, as a percentage of average earnings than it ever has been. And actually, a lot of that's been done without some of the unintended consequences that people were really fearful of. So I think for me, that speaks to the importance of really taking a long-term view here and relying on the experts that you have, like the Low Pay Commission, to really make some of those evidence-based decisions so that you avoid some of the pitfalls there.
That's really interesting because normally people hear, again, something flashy like this and they think, great, brilliant. Mm. But there are always unintended consequences off the back of it, some disadvantages that, you know, like we said, equalizing might have negative impacts on the people that they are equalizing. Of course, from a financial perspective, an 18-year-old might think, great, but they might lose a lot of opportunities to even get that minimum wage in the first place. So that is really interesting. And I hope that 18 to 20-year-olds are kind of listening to this and making sure that this is not just seen from one angle. They are really understanding the consequences of any kind of things that they might have initially seen as just a pro. I've got two more questions for you. Number one is, I think the IFS have discussed the fact that the UK's debt level is currently at a 60-year high. Mm-hmm. Are the parties doing enough to tackle this at all? Are they ignoring it completely? And how does this actually affect the average person in the street?
Yeah. So are they ignoring it completely? No, they're not. Actually, both Labour and the Conservatives have signed up to the current set of fiscal rules. That's a horrible phrase. But essentially, when we're making a budget, we think about tax decisions. People don't like paying tax. We think about spending decisions. People do quite like having spending on public services. And so in an unconstrained world, you just say, well, we're just not going to raise any tax. We're going to spend loads on public services. We're going to borrow all of the money and Bob's your uncle. And so the fiscal rules really come in to try and act as a constraint on that behavior. Because if you borrow more, you might well be able to do that in the short term. But there are kind of long-term consequences you have to keep an eye on. One of those we're seeing right now is that actually one reason that tax revenues are at almost record highs and public service spending is really feeling a lot of pressure, feeling a really tight squeeze, is that we're having to spend a lot more on debt interest than we used to because interest rates have increased. And obviously, the bigger a stock of debt you're carrying, just like on a mortgage, the more debt you have, mm-hmm. the more affected you are by those changes to interest rates, and the more you're going to have to spend just servicing that debt rather than spending on something that you might much prefer to be spending that money on.
Yeah,
so that's one way that debt really affects people. And I think the other way is that in the longer term, we tend to think of borrowing a bit as a free lunch. But actually, it's a two-sided transaction. You need somebody on the other side of that who's willing to lend to you and willing to lend to you at the current rates. Mm-hmm. And so the more, to the extent that the UK is credible and looks like a good, responsible borrower that's going to repay, that's going to service its debt, meet its obligations, all of that kind of stuff, there's usually not really a problem with that. But we saw, and we have seen with, for example, Liz Truss's mini budget, that once you start to erode that credibility, things can go bad quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And in a sort of forever view, if we're borrowing and borrowing and borrowing today to fund a lot of stuff that we just quite like, that we just don't really feel like paying taxes to pay for, that debt stock that we're building up, that gets inherited by future generations who are themselves going to have to pay the taxes to service that debt. So yes, it's a real intergenerational fairness point as well.
Yeah, and something to always keep in mind, this idea of borrowing for today against tomorrow's kind of future. My last question is maybe even your own personal opinion, but something that you wish was in the manifesto from a personal finance perspective, something that's been ignored.
Oh, there's an awful lot.
I'm going to ask you to cherry pick just that so, one that you wish.
I think the problem with asking us about manifesto wish lists is that none of us would ever get elected. I think for me, a lot of it comes down to your political preferences and political priorities. And so there are loads of different things you could do. But there are also a bunch of things that would just make the UK a better place to work. And so I tend to look to the tax system for those. There are lots of completely absurd things in the tax system. One that is definitely not going to get me elected is council tax. We know that council tax hasn't been revalued since 1991. So really, we're in this ridiculous world where you're paying money based on the value of a property 30 odd years ago. And we know that that means that London households are paying disproportionately little and households in the north are paying disproportionately quite a lot. You end up with all of these ridiculous features that just come down to the fact that everyone knows we should be revaluing council tax and no one is quite willing to take that step and do it.
There we go. Council tax. If you're listening and you're an MP, that might be something that you might want to start working on if you want the vote of Christine across the table from me. Christine, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming down, and I hope that we've given someone listening something to take into, well, this Thursday, more or less. So thank you once again.
Thank you very much.
No worries. Anyway, well, stick around because coming up straight after this, I have Becky O'Connor joining us. She is the Director of Public Affairs at Pension B. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. We'll see you there.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
FUBAR Radio presents
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Joining me now, I have Claire Seal, who is a content creator and author.
You know, I think there's loads of shame when it comes to money and financial difficulty, but I honestly think that that shame is really a symptom of the judgment that exists in society. I don't think that people are feeling ashamed for the sake of it. I think they're feeling ashamed because you can't really sort of open your phone or open a newspaper without seeing these huge judgments piled on people who've made mistakes with money. And I think it's acceptable for people to slag you off about being bad with money in a way that it might not be for like other mistakes that you might make.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Malani.
Let's bring in Tobias Elwood, former Defence Minister.
Rishi Sunak has done well to pivot us back, taken us into far calmer political waters.
Has he taken you back into calmer political waters? I mean, you're on track, according to some of the polls, to the largest wipeout in years and, you know, may never return from it. I mean, how has he taken you back into calmer political waters?
We've just seen inflation go down to 2%. Confidence in business is returning.
But is that down to Rishi Sunak?
You've got to let me finish the question. You keep asking me a question and then throwing another question in.
I'm just curious to know, is inflation down to Rishi Sunak?
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
I have this stunning Steph Williams with me now, founder of the We Glow app. I did Turf Games on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And it was horrible. It was horrible. But it was so fun. But it was like savage, right? Yeah. But I wasn't the best in the room and I hate that. And I was like, oh, God, I haven't trained like well enough for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I don't normally think I am. But then when I was there, I was like, this is so annoying because... Yeah. And then I was like, why do I actually need to be good at this, though? Yeah. Like, can I not just do it for fun?
But also, it's like, when I've done, like, casts and stuff before, and the blokes were like, lift that heavier weight, and I'm like, no, like, I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need to lift the heavier weight. Like, I know what I'm capable of. I know what works for my body.
Yeah.
And I think it's just kind of, like, I know what makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you're working out to feel good, you're going to look good.
You're listening to FUBAR
Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show. For those of you that have just joined, I am That Money Guy, and our objective is very simple: to make you better with your money by the end of this show. Last week, if you were listening, I was discussing a recent report that found that 28% of people in the UK, specifically adults, those are, didn't know how much money they needed to save for retirement. That is a lot of people. Anyway, there's a reason why I started with that stat, because I'm being joined right now by Becky O'Connor, the Director of Public Affairs at PensionB. Becky, welcome to the studio. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. I'm going to start, I suppose, at the best place to start. You are the Director of Public Affairs at PensionB. Who are PensionB and what do they do?
PensionB is a leading online pension provider. We offer the option for people to consolidate their old workplace pensions into one online plan with us. So we've got a range of different plans, and we do the gathering of the old pensions for you. So that's where the name PensionB comes into. We do all the worker bee stuff for you to make it that bit easier, which is a good thing if you've got lots of old pensions from lots of old jobs.
Got it. So if you're someone, you've worked a few different careers, probably becoming more and more common for the young generation mm-hmm. these days, who are probably on their seventh job by the time they're 30. You've got no idea where your pension is over here, over there, and pretty much everywhere. You guys are like, well, come to us. We will make it nice and simple and unified for you. Does that summarise it pretty nicely?
Yes, and we do need the basic info. So we need to know kind of where to look first. So you need to be able to at least come up with the name of the provider or the old employer.
Got it. It isn't quite good like start. You could just shout pension at you guys and then you guys go and find exactly...
we're not detectives.
Okay, you're not detectives. No, I'm not a PI. All right, so someone has told you where all their various pensions are. You've done the magic... like you said, the hard work and gone and found them and unified them. Then what are some of the things that you would offer? What are some of the various different packages or pensions that someone can take out with PensionB?
So we have, like employers offer, a default pension plan, which is one that suits the most people. It changes the risk profile. So for younger people, it's invested in sort of high risk equities and all the things that are going to grow or have the potential to grow more over time. And then it kind of de-risks as you get older and you approach retirement. There's a tracker plan, which tracks global stock markets. That's the lowest fee option. And then there's one which is fossil fuel free, if you don't want to invest in oil and gas producing companies. And there's a positive impact plan and also a Sharia plan. So there's a few different options. So you can pick and choose based on your kind of retirement goals and where you are on your kind of career path. Or you can choose a plan that's more kind of in line with your values, whatever they may be.
Brilliant. So it's kind of, you've got an option for everyone, which I suppose is really nice. And you, by the sounds of it, you're keeping things very simple. You're giving them that really overall description.
I think that's so important when it comes to pensions, yes.
I couldn't agree more, because we do not want to overcomplicate the one thing that everyone needs to be thinking about more often and don't need to put off more people. And speaking of a lot of people being mildly confused, the statistic that I opened with just shortly ago, about 28% of the UK not knowing how much they need for retirement. Is this a statistic that surprises you? I'm assuming the answer is going to be no.
I'm surprised it's not even higher, to be honest. Like, honestly, it's so hard to know, because you don't know how much you're going to have from other sources. You don't really know how your current income is going to, or what you're currently living off is going to change when you retire, and perhaps you won't have housing costs anymore. But also, you don't know what you actually want from retirement, because it's not something that we'll think about all the time. So it can be very difficult to know, in the absence of all of those other building blocks, how much you actually need. But I mean, you know, it's very hard and it's very subjective as well, because it does depend what you want. But also, there's this kind of rough guide. So the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association has given us some rough guides to what people might want to save for different living standards. And to get a moderate income based on in retirement every year, based on their living standards guides, you'd be looking at around 300 to 500,000 in your pension pot when you retire, which sounds probably terrifying. but it does, you know, it does build up over time. But it's just to give you an idea of what, you know, kind of what you might need if you want just a moderate living standard, which is like a week long holiday, a few meals out, that kind of thing.
And I think that as scary as that number sounds, sometimes even for the young people listening to this, it's quite important for them to hear that number now, because if they think that they can put off saving towards their pension a little bit further down the line, that number of having, you just said, 300 to 500 grand in your pension to have a moderate lifestyle might make them think, yeah, maybe I need to start contributing a little bit more towards my pension. And I kind of hope that, in a way, sometimes you do need that shock factor to make people a bit more responsible with their money. Now, I'm assuming that that study came out with what you would need in today's money to have a moderate pension.
Yes.
We're not talking, let's say, you're 20, 25 years old. That's not 300 to 500 grand in, what are we looking at, 40 to 50 years?
No, it isn't. No, because the big thing that we don't know is what inflation is going to do between now and when anybody ultimately retires. So that's in today's money. It has to be, because we just don't know what is going to change. But we do have an inflation calculator on the PensionBee website, which is quite fun to play around with, because you can input different inflation figures to see how that changes the amount that you would need to get the same lifestyle. So, you know, if you think inflation is going to run at roughly 2 to 3%, and it is generally speaking around 2.5% on average every year over the long term, then you can see what that figure would translate into at the point in time that you retire, whenever that may be.
Okay, so we've discussed potentially how much you might need in your pension. Let's kind of rewind for a second and come back to, you know, someone that is actively paying into their pension. They're not of pension age just yet, so they haven't filled up the pot just yet. How much does the average person need to be contributing? Is there a way of knowing? Because I'm assuming, and I apologize if you're a listener and I've just assumed wrongly about you, but I'm assuming most people just do the standard quota, you know, that, you know, what is it, 5% they put in, 3% matched by their employee, and they're like, well, that's the maximum amount they're going to match at, so I might as well just stick with that, because I'd rather have more cash in my pocket right now. Is there something else they should be considering?
Yeah, there is. So you're right, the 8% in total, the 5% from you, which includes tax relief, so it's actually less than 5% coming from you, because some of that money is top up from the government, and then 3% from the employer makes the minimum 8% contribution. Now, that is the minimum under auto-enrolment rules. There is guidance, and it's come from industry bodies and, you know, other people, politicians and so on, that should be higher. And there is talk of making that minimum 12%, but really there's a lot of thinking that it should be more like 15% of your salary that's going into your pension. Now, some employers do offer more than the minimum. So I think the average is actually 9%. So the minimum is 8%. The average that would be off would be 9%. So that would be where the employer is offering 4% instead of 3%. But some can be even more generous than that. Some employers will double match your contributions, which means that they'll put in double what you put in, which would take you to something more like 10%. And some will do that up to a maximum. So if you choose to put more in, say you increase your contribution to 7%, they would double match, they would pay in 14%. And in total, you would get 21% going into your pension from your salary every single year. So it's a really good idea to check whether your employer offers a more generous scheme than you've realised, because you might have just signed up for the minimum, gone, that's fine, I'm in, got my pension sorted. They might actually offer you a bit more. Really worth checking that as a starting point.
Of course. And what I always like to tell people is there are a number of things to kind of sort in terms of, like, get your house sorted first before you start really considering upping your pension level to a certain amount. You might think of things like high interest debt, but that's, you know, again, another debate, or just building a general emergency fund. Again, another debate. But one thing that I always tell people that's really important is if your employer is willing to match or give you some more money based off of, you know, whatever policies they have in-house, this is a like free money that you are rejecting in some way, shape or form. Now, I know you can't see that free money for quite a lot of time, but it's essentially increasing your salary by a certain percentage in a way, right? Because like yes. you mentioned, if they're matching 7%, that's another 7% raise, theoretically, that you're rejecting if you don't match it.
It's a complete gift horse and you really don't want to look that in the mouth. And actually, if the scheme is a salary sacrifice scheme, there can be other tax advantages to paying more into your pension too. So it can actually mean that you end up paying slightly less tax, which is something that you would feel in the moment. So it's worth also knowing the type of pension that you're paying into and whether or not those kind of tax benefits would also be felt from increasing your pension contributions now.
Yes. I have one last question for you. Just a nice general one, because I feel like people always want like a nice bit of advice, something they can actually get their teeth stuck into right now. So what is your top tip to someone listening to actually start a pension fund today?
So if you've already got one through work, pay more in if you can. If you feel you can divert an extra, even if it's just an extra £20 a month, that's really going to add up. Don't think it's too small an amount. And if you don't have a pension, perhaps because you're self-employed or because you're too young for one, even because you don't actually get put into an auto-enrollment scheme till you're 22, then you can start one yourself. You can start a personal pension. It doesn't have to be something that you rely on an employer for. And you can start paying in by direct debit in the same way that you pay in to savings accounts, hopefully. It can be really, really easy. So just get started. And if you're already paying in and you can afford a little bit more, then increase it. Then forget about it for a bit. Because this is the beauty with pensions. Like, you can forget about them for a little bit. You just need to check in every now and again.
Brilliant advice. Well, Becky, thank you so much. And I really hope that someone listening out there has taken that advice, will take that advice and actually put it into action. I'm sure they will. Fingers crossed. There we go. And if you guys do want to check out Pension B and consolidate all your thousands of pensions that you've got in hundreds of different places, don't know why I went from thousands to hundreds there, but you get the gist of it if you're listening.
That'll be a lot of jobs.
Then, yeah, look up Pension B and make them do the hard work for you. That's what they're signed up to do, right?
Completely.
All right. Cheers. Have a lovely day.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, there we go. Pensions. I speak about them a lot on this show, and some of you still aren't listening. So this is kind of like your fifth, I won't say your final call, because we'll definitely talk about it again. But another warning, just get on with it, because you can't start soon enough. Anyway, enough from me. My voice went a little bit too high pitch there. Money tip of the week. Welcome to it. This is one of my favorite segments where I will literally give you a short, practical bit of advice that you can go and actually start implementing. I mean, Becky gave you one short a second ago to do with pensions. So you're getting two in the space of 5 minutes. That's pretty good. My one is actually about what's happening this Thursday. And it's quite simple. I think us young people, I'm grouping myself in that, I'm only 26, often think that even if you're registered to vote, because it's too late now to register, so you should be registered to vote, some people think on the day, nah, you know what, like, I just can't be bothered, it's not going to make a difference. All I ask you is go down and actually utilize your vote. If you are registered to vote, please, on Thursday, do not think that your voice isn't important enough. I know this isn't a political show, but we spoke about the manifesto in the first 15 minutes of this show, and we realized there are really, really important things that are each party are kind of advocating for that will actually affect the money in your pocket. So that's kind of my tip to you. I don't even know if it's a tip. It's a bit of advice. I don't know. Maybe just a call to action. But please go and use your vote. I'm not telling you who to vote for. Don't really care. Just please make sure that what you want is put down on a piece of paper this Thursday. Cool. Enough from me. Enough politics from me, for sure. Anyway, we're going to go to a short break. And then I have Tayo Agatanade, co-founder of Bricks with Tips. All things property. We'll see you there.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
FUBAR Radio presents
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Joining me in the studio was AJ and Curtis Pritchard.
When I used to go on Strictly, I used to think of it as like a public service. I'm entertaining somebody for 90
and we
seconds.
And salute you.
And
thank
just like,
you, AJ.
I want people to forget about their problems. I know it's a really weird mentality.
No, it's a... You are right in a way, right? Because there are people that
never made the final.
Oh, yeah, there was no need for that. Well,
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
I'm joined by fellow Love Island contestant Adam Maxted and professional wrestler, may I add. If you could wrestle any celebrity, who would it be?
I'm trying to think who would be...
Someone needs to be like your height, your size. Come on, you've got to be fair about it. It can't be like a little weasel.
Maybe like Anthony Joshua or something.
Jesus. Really? You reckon you could take Anthony Joshua?
In a boxing fight, probably not.
But in a wrestling match. Yeah.
In a wrestling match, I back myself.
Okay, fair.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
TikTok sensations Jack and Sorrel. Iconically, there have been some amazing celeb couples. Who would be your favourite of all times?
David Beckham and Victoria.
Goals.
I just think, like, the twists and turns of it all, but still being together like that, to me, is peak celeb.
For me, do you know what? I just love a good power couple. We had Beyonce, Jay-Z. Like,
yes.
I want them to reign highly. I want them to be girl bossing, man bossing, just bossing throughout, and us obsessed with them separately and together.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. I am That Money Guy. And if you are just joining us, I like to say this every single time, you listen to this show and you get better with money. Simple as. And how am I going to make you better with money? Well, I'm actually not really going to do that because I've got someone joining me right now. Tayo, the co-founder of Bricks with Tips. Welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing?
I'm great, man. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you because I've seen a lot of your content online and on TV, I will add. just to sprinkle in an intro for those that don't know you. I mean, is there a BAFTA award in there as well? Am I right in saying that?
Yes, yes. The Great House Giveaway won a BAFTA award for Best Daytime TV Shows. So, yeah. Proud achievement, 100%.
Voila, there you go. So to give some context to your listening, if you want to get anything to do with property knowledge, so investing in property, understanding how it works, generally maybe even buying your own property for the first time, Tayo's your guy. Bricks with Tips. I mean, it's in the name, right? Tips, bricks, you know, put the words together. it's logical. I want to ask you, how did this all come about, this page, this personality, this entire career?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. I think that if I take it all the way back to university, I studied economics, but I had this love for cars, right? Every single year, I used to stay back in the summer, work like a job in like a telephone call center, and just save all of my money and buy a new car every new year, right? But you quickly find that every single year you buy a new car, right? It's going down in value when you sell the old one. And as an economics student, it's like, this isn't even a light bulb moment. This is literally what I'm studying.
Incoming, so, outgoing, it makes a lot of sense.
Literally, so I was like, you know, when I come out of uni, I'm going to buy something that's going to rather than depreciate. So when I finally do sell it, I've got more money than what I put in. And I guess that simple rationale is kind of what university. I often say to people that the frequency in that I saw a property transaction, it was so frequent that it made it seem just super possible for me. So I bought my first home. And when I bought my first home, I was relatively young, 22 years old. And naturally, I had a lot of questions about how do I do this? How do I do that? And I was answering a lot of questions. And effectively, my girlfriend, now wife at the time, was like, do you know what? You're spending 3 hours on a phone, 4 hours on a phone every evening. We don't get any quality time together. Let's create a page where we put the message out once and it just goes out there. And that's the power of social media, right? So we started in 2019. In 2020, a production company that worked with Channel 4 said that, hey, look, we think you'd be great for television. And then, yeah, nothing was the same from there.
Wow. What a great story. And I love the start of it, actually. It was, you know what? I'm 22. Let me just go and throw some money at something and we'll figure it out. It was kind of like,
literally,
do the purchase. Like, logically, you knew it made sense. But I suppose practically, there were so many details I'm assuming that hit you once you'd actually made that purchase. Things that you had to learn on the job, right? And as you learn, you taught. Which is a really clever way to go about things, because that's probably, or I always say, that's the most accessible way for someone to actually learn about something. Not from someone who's 10 years ahead of you, 20 years ahead of you, but from someone who's 30 seconds ahead of you, because they'll have just done it and can give you the exact insights that are relevant to you. So I love that you did that.
Absolutely. I often say to people that, like, even when I'm doing speaking engagements, I'm saying that, look, we've got everyone's got two ears and one mouth, right? So everybody's a student and everyone's a teacher. So literally, there's a first-time buyer that might be in this room. And even though I'm a first-time buyer expert, first-time buyer that completed yesterday, there's a great amount of things that they probably know better than me at this point in time, because I completed my first home some years ago. So, I couldn't agree more with you. And I think that it's just super important to do that. And everyone can learn from each other effectively.
For sure. I mean, you're literally preaching my ideology. I mean, I started a page about financial education. Everyone was like, are you qualified? I was like, no. They were like, how can you educate? I go, well, I've just learned it. I've implemented it and I've shared my learnings. And they were like, can't argue with that. I guess that's a really strong argument. Okay, so now let's dive into a little bit about property, because I feel like the young generation, people our age, you know, in their 20s, are more disconnected than ever before with this idea that they might one day get on the property ladder. Forget people in the 20s, 30s, even 40s. I think the average first-time buyer is now 36, if the latest records are still imprinted in my brain somewhere. So do you think it's still a viable option for young people either to get into property through investing or to get into a property through, I want to live in this and I want it to be my home?
Yeah, I think both are definitely still viable at this point in time. What we're experiencing in the UK is really, really bad, no doubt about it. And there's no doubt that buying a property is difficult. And I make sure that I say that in the front end, because you can't invalidate anybody's experiences. It is tough. Mm-hmm. What I will say is that there's an element of history, right? So we even see in other big cities across the world, like New York or Toronto, cities like New York, everybody lives in like New Jersey and they commute in. London hasn't got to that point where it's basically not livable unless you're a multimillionaire, but it definitely does seem like it's heading that way. And not to focus on London, we have this issue across the UK. What I will say to people is that you have to kind of get comfortable doing something that other people aren't willing to do. And that isn't always an easy thing. The reason why I say that is that we briefly mentioned me buying my first home at the time, and you're absolutely right. It wasn't an easy decision. I moved to an area. I lived in Southeast London. I moved to an area in deep Kent that some of my friends had even heard of. Never even heard of the area.
How far was the commute for your mates to come and see you?
Honestly, like, people came for the housewarming. I hadn't seen them since. That was basically it.
You figured out very quickly who your real friends were, yeah?
So it was a thing whereby sometimes there's that element of that. There may have to be that sacrifice. And the reason why I say that as well is that a huge part of what you can afford to buy is based on your earnings. Now, in the UK, compared to other countries, our earnings aren't, there's not that many huge anomalies. I often say to people that if you go to like the States, you can have someone who earns 30K walk on the street next to someone that earns 800K very frequently. That doesn't really happen that much in the UK, basically. No. So as a result, there's always going to be like hotspots that people are moving to. And it doesn't matter where you live. Like, even if you live in like Manchester, there was a period that people were moving to like Middleton, Stockport, so on and so forth, basically. And that trend is always going to be there. What you want to do, you want to kind of work out where can people afford to buy now and maybe take that jump to the next town that you reckon is going to be best if it's got good transport links, so on and so forth. But once again, I'll just end with, by no means is it easy. It's very difficult. I often say, I made a video one time called "It's Not London, It's Not You, It's London," and that was for the Londoners. But in general, I guess this is the message to all first time buyers: it's not you, it's the UK housing system. Like, it's messed up. So let's start off with saying it's not a you problem. It's a problem with UK housing. But let's still see what we can try and do.
Yeah. And I know you just said a lot there, but I always like to reiterate when there was a little bit of gold in there, and there was for a moment, what you said was to get something that you really want, you know, to get that incredible thing, which is a property. It is an incredible acquisition to make. sometimes it has to come with some sacrifice, and you just have to decide the pros and cons, right? You said you went all the way out to Kent, but that got you onto the property ladder, right? And then you kind of worked your way upwards from there. In life, always, you know, risk and rewards, they're kind of finely balanced. There's a bunch of pros to doing something and there'll be a bunch of cons. You've just got to weigh up the two and make the right decision for you. And I think that's absolute gold because people often want to have their cake and eat it. Is that the right saying? So it's this idea. Sometimes, like you said, a bit of sacrifice to get yourself started and down the lines. I always say that with personal finance. My biggest tip to someone is you don't have to stop spending right now, but you do have to stop spending on the things that don't mean something to you. So for sure, if you love food, that's what gives you life, let's say. You want to go eat in nice restaurants. I beg you, go and eat in nice restaurants. If that's what gives you energy, it gives you life. But please stop shopping in fancy, bougie, luxury stores every other weekend as well, because you can't have both. You have to pick. And this is kind of the trade and playoffs. But enough about me and my advice. We've got you in the studio because of your advice. So yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, it's amazing you say that, because I say exactly the same thing. Often when I'm talking about my story, I often say that, look, when it comes to saving for a home, I never say like, you got to eat sardines or whatever, but it's like, pick the things that you love. That's literally what I say. Do you love going on holidays? Do you love going on holidays more than you like going out? All right, cool. Maybe you reduce the going out, but you maintain the holidays. It just means that you still have that quality of life, but you're still working towards that goal. Yeah. But yeah, sorry, let's get stuck into some questions.
Let's do the property stuff then. So 22, your first property. Where are we up to now? Let's talk about some successes and some failures in your own personal journey.
So I'd say I had to learn by experience, right? That means learning by experience in a number of different ways through my property journey. But to give you a quick rundown of how my property journey went, I bought my first home. I learned from what I learned in university, it's a multi-let. So your landlord typically rents out room by room. Mm-hmm. So when I bought my first property, I lived in one room and rented out the other two rooms, basically. To people that needed the room, right?
Yep.
It basically just meant by month two, I basically wasn't paying a mortgage by month two, effectively. After that, I knew that I was going to propose to my now wife at some point. So what I did, and this is a key topic as well, I refinanced my existing home, kept it, and bought another one with my wife, basically. Fast forward to today, and I want to talk about getting on the ladder and how things can change when you're on the ladder. Mm-hmm. And I'm always very, very transparent as well. So sometimes when I was trying to learn about property at the time, I was watching videos and people were like, yeah, so I just bought this house for £1 million cash. And it kind of makes me tune off, right? So it's important to hear numbers. I wasn't earning a stupid salary or anything like that. My first home cost me £151,000 for a 3-bedroom house in an area in Kent, basically. And that's just down the M2. So fast forward to today, my wife and I have got 7 properties. We have one that we live in, 2 that we're keeping for our children because we've got 2 daughters. But all of the properties that we don't live in, we issue to supported living. And that's for people that have got so a company will come and take it on. They'll take over the property, mm-hmm. and they'll adapt the property to help people that have got disabilities and things like that, or 16 to 18 year olds that need a place to live, basically. So that's where we're at today. But the key thing I wanted to let people know about buying your first home is that it's going to be the toughest, right? I often say to people, someone like myself, and I'll give myself an example, if I wanted to move home, I don't necessarily need to pay for a deposit. The reason why that is that I have lived in my current home for 5 years. So for 5 years, I've benefited from capital appreciation, mm-hmm. which can be in the tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands. And I've been paying my mortgage off for 5 years. So I get that equity in between. And quite often than not, what someone on the ladder already does, that's already on the ladder, they'll sell their home and just use that bit in the middle to put as a deposit on their new home. Mm-hmm. And I often say that first time buyers is very difficult because you might be renting and trying to save at the same time. So it's kind of like you're pouring water into a bucket that's got a hole in it, right?
Yeah.
So it is really, really difficult. I just want to reiterate that. But when you finally get to that goal, I do want to reassure first time buyers that you start to build equity and it does get a bit easier.
I think that's really nice for someone to say that, because it's appreciating just how difficult that first step is. And that's the position that most people probably listening are in. Most people don't have their first property yet, especially in their 20s and 30s, as opposed to do. And it's this idea that, you know, you push over that first domino and they do start to fall. It's not like it's completely easy. You still got to put in a lot of hard work, but things are mildly easier. So kind of what are your top key tips for someone that wants to get on the property ladder today? What should they be doing?
Yeah, so I recently did a webinar actually, telling people, we my wife and I have been doing this for 5 years, right? And we've noticed that there are a few things that people need in order to be successful, right? So these are the four things that the people that are successful typically have, and the four things that I want people that are thinking about doing it to try and get in place. So one of the first things is the education. People underestimate, and you can testify to this as well, people underestimate how powerful education is. It is as valuable as money when it comes to making or retaining or protecting your wealth effectively. Education is key. Sometimes there may be, even if it's a scheme that you don't know about, or there's people that walk around and they think that the minimum deposit is 15%. When it's really 10%. And then all of a sudden, when they learn that, it shaves a year or two off the time that they need to save. And that's why I say that education is key. So that's the first thing. The second thing is a clear goal or plan. So, so important in property. You're saving for a deposit, but you don't even know what the end goal is. You don't know what you're saving to. So I often say that you might be £500 away from your goal. You just don't know. So you end up YOLOing a trip to Dubai for 3K. And now you didn't hit your goal because you don't even know where the end goal is. So please get a goal, make a plan. The third thing is reliable professionals. So what I mean by that is that a mortgage broker is gonna, this is probably one of the best professionals in the UK. The reason why I say that is that they can work with you for a whole year for free. They only charge a fee when they submit the mortgage application, and they will help you create a goal and create a plan. They will be like, look, this is where you could potentially buy. This is the sort of deposit you'll need. How much are you saving? Let's look at your bank statements, so on and so forth. And then your solicitors, surveyors, and so on and so forth. So the professionals. And the fourth one is one that people don't often tap into.
Okay, I like it. We're going to get a secret fourth step. I love it.
And it's an engaged community, right? What I mean by that, I always give this example, right? And I'm only giving this example because we're in the Euros, right? We're in the season of the Euros. If you were someone who grew up around professional footballers, like your friends, you grew up with like Phil Foden, Jude Bellingham, whatever, basically, and you went goals with them frequently, but you weren't that good at football, because they were, your mindset is kind of like a higher standard. So when you come and play football with everyday Joe Bloggs like you and I, you're going to be the best because you're used to kind of like a higher standard.
Everyday
now,
Joe
I'm
Bloggs,
digress,
mate.
You, see what I'm getting
you haven't
this.
Seen my left foot, mate. sorry for interrupting you now. That's great.
Yeah, to make it clear. What I mean by that is that I often find that people that are successful in buying their first home, they've got people around them that are doing the same thing. It's very, very hard to work towards a goal when you haven't got a community that supports that goal or can relate to that goal, and so on and so forth. And the truth is, not everybody has that community. But this is why I say it's so important to tap into pages like yours or pages like mine, and make sure that every single day you're getting that reminder and that encouragement and that kind of like sense of community, in that this is the goal that I want to get to and this is how I'm going to get there, because it is extremely difficult to do it alone. It's a lonely road. But yeah, those are my four pillars.
Listen, I promise the listeners every week that they will get better with their money by the end of this show. I don't even think they have to stick around till the end of this show, because they've just got it there with the four tips. Honestly, that was unbelievable. And even I learned something there. I'm so, obviously, what you're saying there about the community aspect resonates with me so much, because that's what I'm trying to build with the financial knowledge. But I'm trying to buy my first time property as well. And I'm like, well, why am I not, like, literally, with what your interests are and your passions and what you're trying to do. I mean, we literally have social media at our fingertips. You can use it for bad. You can use it just to mindlessly scroll for 3 hours of your life. that's probably even a low amount. Or you can download and digest the information that you're trying to get and actually go and find it because it exists out there. So this is perfect time. I want you to plug yourself right now. If someone is out there, they want to join a community of people that are trying to get into the property market through investing, through living, first-time properties, where can they go?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity. How long have you got?
7 seconds.
Yeah, so guys, follow us on at Bricks with Tips on all platforms. That's Bricks with a Z and Tips with a Z. So BRICKZWITHTIPZ. And that's on everything. Facebook, LinkedIn, TikTok, Instagram, the lot. We cleared it all. Second one is if you're super, super serious about buying your first home in the next 18 months, we created a platform whereby you will get those four things: a clear goal savings plan through one-to-ones with myself, an engaged community in the platform itself, professionals in the platform in itself, and education, because we've got hours and hours of content on buying your first home in the platform itself. That all exists in a platform called the Home Buyers Club. So if you just go to www.thehomebuyers, so home B-U-Y-E-R-S, club.co.uk, you can, I think we're on a waiting list now, you can join the waiting list, but I'll review it. And if I know that you watch the show, I'll give you a fast track to get entry. Yeah,
I like
and then
it.
The final thing is new digital TV show on Channel 4 Digital called Make Your Move. It's out there right now. If you just put in Make Your Move space title in YouTube, you'll see the digital TV show of Channel 4. It's live now.
I love that. Honestly, we didn't even get into the whole TV stuff. But Ty, listen, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. And yeah, well, I feel like we've given them enough to get started. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree, man. I agree. Right. Thank you for having me.
Have a great day.
Same to you.
All right. Sweet. There you go. I mean, do we need to give you any more information when it comes to buying your first-time property? Probably, but that's a pretty good place to start. I've only got you for a little bit longer, but one thing I did want to share with you is something that actually happened to me, was it about a week or two ago? So I actually met Keir Starmer and got the chance to interview him about what he's going to be actually doing from a financial perspective if he gets into power. A pretty cool experience for myself, especially as at the beginning of the show, we were talking about various manifestos and what's going on. And yeah, I just thought it was worth bringing into this show the opportunities that I've been able to get from just putting myself out there on a public forum and trying to advocate for being this financial educator within the UK. Obviously, it's lacking from our everyday systems in terms of schooling, university, anywhere else where you get your formal education from. So I've been trying to do it on social media. I've been trying to do it even more so through That Money Show, where you're listening to me right now. And this is my whole objective, is to get you better with money. And apparently the powers that be are listening, and they want someone like me to come and interview the potential, and at the moment very likely, future PM about his financial policies, to spread what he's going to plan to do with, you know, the people that listen to me, which was a really, really cool experience. Pretty wild. Had to get to Reading in like the space of half an hour. Don't ask how I did that. But anyway, I sat down, I spoke with him. He is, let's just say, definitely more engaging in real life than he's made out to be by the general media. He did tell me that his dad was a toolmaker, which I know has been doing the rounds on social media. But it was a really genuine interview. If you do want to head over to my own personal finance, personal social media pages to listen and see that interview there, go check it out. And I would love to hear your thoughts. Rishi, if you're listening, down to do an interview, hit me up. Anyway, I do always like to squeeze in a question, because you guys have been DMing at That Money Show on Instagram to ask us your personal finance questions. And I always promise that I will answer them, but we don't have a lot of time. So I'm literally going to answer one quick one. And this one is from, pick a question, any question. Wayne, because this is a good one. Wayne, you are a student that works part-time in a takeaway shop, and you also want to pick up some private tutoring work on the side. Would you have to declare this to HMRC if you are already working and paying tax? So here are the rules for you side hustlers out there. If you're already paying tax, remember, you get £12,570 worth of income tax free every single year. But if you've crossed that threshold and you are already starting to pay tax, and then you start another little side gig, these are the rules. You get £1,000 tax free. So that's right. You can earn £1,000 from your little tutoring. I say little. That was very condescending. I apologize. From your private tutoring side hustle that's on the side, If it goes over that amount, it joins, you know, your general income tax, and you have to start creating a self-assessment. You have to declare yourself as self-employed and create that and submit your taxes on the internet. So those are the rules. Wayne, I hope that was helpful. Yeah, £1,000 kind of tax-free is what it is. So yeah, listen, for those of you that are out there and have those questions you're too embarrassed to ask, Wayne, you came to the right place. You DM'd us at That Money Show. But remember, you can reach us on that profile. Just go into the DMs, ask us your question. We can answer it fully anonymously. Wayne was willing to for us to use his name. You might not be, but that's fine. We don't have to. So yeah, DM us with your questions and we will answer them next week. I'll try and do more than one. I also want to thank everyone that joined me today on the show as well. So we had Christine from the Institute of Fiscal Studies. I know we're getting really cool people to this studio. Becky O'Connor, the Director of Public Affairs at PensionBee, those people that will group all of your pensions from various companies into one nice centralized place. Sounds pretty useful to me. I actually might go look them up and see if I can do that myself after the show. And also Tayo, the co-founder of Bricks with Tips. That's Bricks and Tips with a Z. Chatting to me all things first-time properties, property investing, seems to be like the go-to guy. We're really bringing you some leaders and thought leaders in various categories, mainly so you don't have to just listen to me straight for an hour, but also selfishly, I have learned so much from various weeks and specifically from today. So remember, you can listen to us live on the FUBAR Radio app. You can get us on all good podcasting stations. Wherever you get your podcasts, check us out. I've been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show, and we'll see you next week to teach you more about money.